My claim to fame is Terrence worked for me at Coca-Cola. As you can see, it didn't take a lot of foresight to determine that he had a lot of talent. I worked for the Coca-Cola company. I was senior vice president of sales when Terrence worked for me. Senior vice president of sales, and Terrence was my head of national accounts, and what a great guy. Since 2000, I've been teaching at the Emory Business School at Guisueta. I've left Coca-Cola. So Terrence and I got reconnected at a conference I was at and hadn't seen him for a number of years, and it was really great to see him. And he said, "Oh, I've got this great FCCI," and I'd really never heard of FCCI, I've got to be honest. And he started explaining it to me, and so I went to one of his meetings one morning, and I was really impressed with the people at FCCI and the guys, the small group that I met with. And he said, "Would you speak at our conference?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'd be glad to do that." And he said, "Besides, you know, these people are really nice, and even if you're bad, they're going to be nice to you. So I'm counting on that. But what I'd like to do is just share with you some of the experiences I have and some of the learning that I've done about business development, because that's really my area at Emory, about business development. But more importantly, at the end, what I'd like to do is spend the last 15 minutes, so I've got about 20 minutes of slides and stuff, but to hear from you about, you know, basically kind of put together what I've talked about, and then what is your experience? What advice do you have, or experiences that you have forming a business? How many of you actually are business owners? I can't. Oh, great. So what I'd like to do, here's your assignment, you know, being teaching, I give you an assignment, is I want you to think about some of the things that I say today. And then at the end, share with the group, the last 10 minutes, we'll share with the group what your experiences are. Last night, when I listened to Horst speak, first thing I would do is make it mandatory that any new employee you bring into your organization, I'd make them listen to that discussion that he had last night. What a powerful message. But the three things that he talked about in his business, you know, deficit-free, you know, make sure there's no deficiencies in your product, timeliness, and friendliness. And when I think about that as I talk about some of these slides, and what are the three things that you hold dear to your business? What are the three things that, you know, that you stake your business on? So let me go through one of the things I started reading about FCCI, and I thought this was really interesting. Are you a steward or the owner of a company? And I read through the materials to try to get ready to have a discussion today. And a company for Christ is dynamic with a life of its own and a service of God in whom it finds purpose. And that's a powerful message. You know, when I think about a business, and I hadn't really thought of it that way. But you know, you really can't own a business, can you? Because the business that you left when you came here is going to be different than the business that you have when you go back. It's dynamic, it's moving and changing every minute. And the role of the CEO, then, I thought, is to kind of create and nurture these conditions for success. How do you make this business? What is my role as the leader of this company? And so when I think about building a company for Christ, I said, so the way I kind of took an academic approach to it, I said, how would I start building a company for Christ? And I guess the first thing I'd do is find a customer. And I spun that because if it's really boring, at least I'll amuse you with the animation, okay? But I'd find a happy customer. You know, what is your customer? Having a real, you know, first of all, before you have a business, you have to have a customer. And when I listened to Horst last night, it reminded me when he talked about this customer loyalty. Xerox did a study, and what made me think about it last night was when he mentioned the terrorist. customer loyalty. And what if you look on an axis, the vertical axis, being a highly satisfied customer, very loyal customer, always only do business with you, down at the bottom, never do business with you, never again do business with you, the customer loyalty axis. And along the bottom, if you think about a customer satisfaction, number one being extremely dissatisfied, and to the far right, extremely satisfied. And what Xerox did a number of years ago in this study is they tried to map this and try to identify their customer loyalty. And what they found, bottom left hand, obviously, very dissatisfied and never again, they called this person, this individual, a terrorist. Why do you think they called him a terrorist? Anybody have an idea about that? You ever had a bad experience, like in a restaurant or in a... What do you want to do after that? Tell everybody. You can't wait to tell somebody. In fact, you meet a guy on the street, a stranger, you say, let me tell you about this restaurant. It was really, really bad. And so they termed this person as a terrorist. But the interesting thing about that study is that basically the line goes up a little bit, but it's almost flat in terms of customer loyalty until you get 8.5 to 9, and then it starts to move up. So unless the customer is highly or very satisfied, their loyalty is unaffected. And so the importance that Horace talked about last night to this precision about the process is so important. So I say one of the things I think about is try to know my customer. Identify the most profitable customers. And a lot of times that most profitable customer isn't your biggest customer because you've got to think about the cost to serve this customer, obviously. But identify those most, because the most loyal customers, ideally you want to have as your most profitable customers. Turn every customer into an opportunity. Build the capability to solve problems on the first contact. That's really becoming more and more important with so many of the automated systems that we encounter today. People get so frustrated. One of the biggest problems with customer service today is this problem about not being able to get to somebody, not be able to speak to a human being. Follow your customers across channels. That is so important today because of the different opportunities that they have to interact with your products or services. You know yourself how many different channels that you enter into to engage with the products. And do whatever is necessary to solve a problem. One of the highest customer satisfaction ratings is when service recovery. Service problems happen, but the most important driver of customer service is to be able to recover from that. Because when you have a problem with a product or service, the first thing you think about is I'm going to encounter another problem. Now I'm going to walk up to the customer service person. I'm going to call in and I know I'm going to have... You get anxious. You get all worked up because you're going to have to try to defend your position or you have to explain it. And when somebody calls in with a problem or deals face-to-face with a problem, if you solve it in a compassionate way, the customer satisfaction doesn't, it just accelerates. It's a really a powerful way. Service recovery is one of the best ways to build customer satisfaction. Hacks. Mistakes happen, take advantage of it. The other part is a winning business strategy. I think about you have a customer, so a winning business strategy. Just quickly, these aren't the only ways to think about it, but think about what is your core competency of your business. What do you build your business around? And here are three examples. One would be what you're known for or your capability is organizational excellence, product leadership, or customer intimacy. We used to have an expression at Coke, if you're everything to everybody, you're nothing to nobody. What is your focus of your organization? And then you build your process and structure and culture around it. Let me just give you a brief example. Process. If you think about the process and operational excellence, it's a no-hassle distribution system. Your focus on distribution. Different in product leadership, It's about innovation pipeline, constantly bringing new products into the market. Or customer intimacy, be the customer. When think about that, you know, I had an experience with FedEx a number of years ago. They actually, when they wanted to get a new pretty big part of the business that we had, they actually had us as a package. They picked us up as a package and went through the whole system. It was just such a remarkable experience to be the customer, you know, to really live their belief. Structure of the organizations, again, are fit differently. You think about a focus, a channel of operational excellence, strong central decision rights. You don't want a lot of flexibility in terms of having decision rights on operational excellence. Loose-knit, ever-changing, product leadership, very loose, free organization. And in customer intimacy, it's about empowerment and flexibility. The culture, again, in operational excellence, it's about continuous improvement. It's about risk-taking and reward in an innovation. You don't want a lot of risk-taking if your focus is having a very tight-knit, close-knit operational or distribution system. You don't want a lot of flexibility in that. But here, it's risk-taking is rewarded in innovation, new ideas, new products. And in customer intimacy, it's about adapting and accommodating. When you think of a customer in operational excellence, you think about Amazon. They have it down. It's not that you do these things to the exclusion of the others, but you try to focus your energy or your organization against what your core competency is. Another one in product leadership, what comes to mind? What's a company that comes to mind when you think about new innovative products? Apple, yeah. Apple, obviously. Nike, a lot of these companies. In those organizations, I spent quite a bit of time consulting with Nike, and the whole organization embodies risk-taking and excitement and new product and innovation. Customer intimacy, you couldn't think of a better one than Ritz-Carlton. They defined, I think, customer intimacy. So the idea here is a business strategy supports, you know, basically trying to get customers and what is your core focus and then how you think about, and what Horst talked about last night was this process, the importance of that. And so I'd like to talk a minute about that. Excuse me. So again, remember your assignment. You know, what are the three things that, you know, your organization really focuses on at the end? I'd really like to share this. Because as I mentioned, I've never built a company but you guys have, and I think the idea to learn, we had an expression, nobody is as smart as everybody. You know, we get together, I mean, once, you know, the idea about idea sharing and building the culture to learn from one another is powerful. The value system drives the strategy. And what I mean by the value system, historically you think about the value system is in a business environment is how value is added to a business. And a lot of the work back in the 80s and the 90s, you think about the value chain. They take each step of the value chain from resourcing to production to marketing to manufacturing to marketing to sales to the customer. Motorola really pioneered this work, and Jack Welch at General Electric really took it on and made it this mantra. You heard a lot about Six Sigma. What they did is they took each step of the value chain, you know, basically took each one of it and dissected it and decided which areas that we really need to focus the organization on or try to outsource a lot of that time, a lot of outsourcing. What's happened since then is they've taken each one of those, you know, Michael Porter's done a lot of work, some of you have taken marketing classes, about taking each one of those elements, not necessarily the value chain, but taking each element of value and how it's added to the business. And the reason I bring this up is last night, or yesterday, when I listened to about the change in the culture and how the values are shifting, because I think that what's important today and going forward is different than in the 90s and even in the early 2000s. is that the value systems of the value chain and being able to do Six Sigma marketing, they had you had a consistent core of values amongst the workforce. They kind of viewed their jobs the same way as the management viewed their jobs. And so you're able to enable organizational changes much more effectively. But when I listened yesterday about the value shift from work to comfort to duty to experience, family to independence, frugal to acceptance, there's a whole value shift, not only within the business, but a value shift within the people that operate within the business. And so I think the value chain, this value system is even more important today than it ever was, because it starts to communicate what is important, determines priorities, influences the behavior of the organization, inspires action, shapes the culture. You can read the different thing, contributes to your success. And I think winning leaders live their values. Their personal conduct embodies their values. The actions reinforce these values in others. I think people, teaching at Emory, I'm in the MBA program, and these guys want a different experience now than I did when I went to school. It's not the same. It's not your father's Oldsmobile anymore. They want a different way about how they're viewed in the organization. And they look to leaders that believe in what they are saying. We had an expression at Coke. Does the audio match the video? You ever watched a movie that's kind of out of sync? You know, this guy's saying one thing and doing another thing? That's very discomforting to the young people today, the guys, the new employees coming to the workforce. But I think where you have the secret sauce, and I was talking to Terrence about this the other day, I said, I don't know what I'm going to tell, you know, I don't know about building a business. But when I think about FCCI, I think your Christian values is really as sets you apart. Not only have a value system, but these embodied Christian values. And when Terrence and I got reconnected, I was doing some work with a faith-based ministry in Atlanta. And we were trying to define what Christian values really are in these men. There's a group of men that got together, very similar. They weren't members of FCCI. They're a very similar concept, a men's ministry. And what we found, they asked me to do some work with them, I was involved with it, is that it's really hard for the men to define what their values are. You know, I got Christian values, but I really don't know what they are. So the work that we were doing when I got reconnected with Terrence is Christian values, envision your values, is visit. What we try to do is, do you view these to be valid 100 years from today? If you were to start a new organization, would you build these core values into the new organization, regardless of what your product or services were? And that's kind of how we started this. And this is just some ideas that we talked about. So we thought the character, faith, and leadership are really important values in business today. And I'll just share with you these ideas that came up. This was from these aren't necessarily mine. These came from this group that I was working with. Stewardship, confidence in God, spiritual drive, and prayer. Those embody those values. A willingness to place trust in the hand of providence. Firm desire to live one faith and thought. Character. Prudence. Perseverance. Self-mastery. Do these seem reasonable? They seem out of the aligned with kind of my on the same page a little bit with how you're feeling. And the last one we came up with, leadership. Excellence, magnanimity. So I thought these were powerful. I think that the more we can, that not only that we define what our values are and we put them into the business, but we live those values, because that's what the workforce is looking for today, living those values. I did a lot of work with a Professor Demery, Jack Sheth, how do we create a client for life? How do you create a client for life? We had a project relative to that, and what we determined were there were six or seven characteristics of that, but the three that I want to talk about very briefly is integrity, empathy, and conviction. What we talk to consulting practices, we talk to different companies that engaged with consultants, and that was the focus of this study. And we said, what is it that you look for from a trusted advisor? When you trust, and these were the three things that really came through, along with good judgment, wisdom, knowledge, selfless independence. But what these things really resonated with me, these heartfelt conviction. And what they said, I want to look to someone that has beliefs and actions and choice, inspire others to follow what a man lives for. I think Martin Luther King had a, if a man has nothing worth dying for, then he has nothing worth living for. Another one is empathy. What business leaders told us, CEOs and executives said, I want someone, a consultant that has empathy with me, what I'm going through, experiencing that. Humility. The last one is integrity. When you think about integrity, it's about building, primarily it's focused on trust. And trust is a function of character plus competence times the risk associated with it. Think about that. It's a relatively important concept. If you think about character, lives up, honest, I trust this person with my family, I trust this person, but also competence. Your neighbor might be really, trust them to take care of your house, your kids, your dogs, whatever, but if you're going to have heart surgery, it'd be a little bit questionable whether you'd let them do that. You want to make sure the person has competence as well as his character. And it's all associated with the risk. The higher level of risk that you ask this person to engage in, the more these principles come into play. So risk is an important part of integrity. And the way to sustain your business model is through your team. Roberto Goizueta, chairman of the Coca-Cola company, had a line that I always remember. He said, the only really sustainable competitive advantage any business has is the knowledge of the workers. Your competition can't copy that. And so you think about the skills and capabilities of the organization. We focus a lot about that. But what I heard a lot about here is also the attitudes and the beliefs of the workers, your workforce. Not only their capabilities, but their attitudes and beliefs. And the last is about their leadership, is your leadership. And I know I've heard some of this talk here about servant leadership, which I think is powerful, servant leader. And I'm on a board of a small private school, and the whole staff has gone through servant leadership, and it's really a powerful paradigm. But one last thing I'd like to leave you with is about matching leadership to readiness. Because what happens in business is you have a way to tendency to treat everybody the same. If you're really a good coach, if you're really a good mentor, you kind of get focused into that style. And just one thing I want you to think about is to align your leadership with the readiness of the person to do the job. We have a lot of times I noticed in business, we'd have a tendency to treat everybody the same. You're a great guy, you've done this in the past. But a lot of times you want to think about is their motivation and their ability to do it. It's called situational leadership. This person maybe has never done this before, might have great capabilities, might be really a smart person, but they've never done this, especially now as you continue to change process and systems in a business, this person becomes, I don't know how to do it. The last thing this person needs is a pat on the back and say, I know you can go do it. What this person needs is directing, and he needs checking. You know, okay, here's how you do it. I'm going to check your work, because this person really is very unmotivated to do it. Here you have another guy, I can just go right through, man, I know how to do it, just get out of my way. But Dad's never done it before. A little different style. What you want to do here is coaching and teaching. You know, this, you don't want to discourage this person from taking on new initiatives, but you want to try to change your leadership style a bit. This person here, a lot of us encountered this, is I am frustrated with this. I'm not motivated to do this. I can do it. I can't do it anymore. I've just done this time and time again. And so what I would suggest, and this person needs listening and supporting. And the last is about a person that has high motivation and high. This person doesn't need a lot of coaching, doesn't want to, you know, come on, let me show you this. They want some delegation and encouragement. And so one thing I'd like to leave, this is the last slide I have, the one thing I'd like to leave you with is to try to match your leadership style with the readiness of the individual to be able to do that. So, your assignment. Does anybody like to share with the group the three distinctive characteristics or the things that you hold most dear in your business? I'll make you stand in the corner. Yeah, please.
Our business has...
Yeah, what is your business? Would you...
My name is Dan, and I, and we have a medical clinics in Dallas, Texas.
Uh-huh.
Respect and growth. And with those, I think, you know, those fit into a lot of the things that you were saying, whether you were starting a business today or, you know,
100 years
from now.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, would they change depending upon the product? And I think that they wouldn't. So I like that. And then the other thing is that revenue is a byproduct of good systems and processes. So we don't focus on money, we focus on how do we make the processes support both the practitioners as well as our patients.
Oh, terrific. Boy, I tell you, Horst talked about process last night. You know, it's just so important to align those against your outcomes. Thank you very much. Anybody else? Business owners?
When you do that, then the money comes.
Absolutely.
Because the reputation that you build and the referrals that you get, which is better than any marketing program that you can do when the personal referrals go out. And so it's wonderful that you guys are able to concentrate on those things, because it'll happen and it will come.
Well, we say that to we have a VP of marketing, you know, with this trip, but you know, we spend a lot of money marketing and technology and SEO and all that fun stuff, but our message to our staff is our best marketing team is our 15,000 patients that are out there talking about how well they're taken care of and how when they come into our offices that it feels different. So absolutely.
Word of mouth is by far the most powerful marketing aspect that you can have for your business, you know, happy customers. Anybody else in that business? Do you have a business?
I do not. I'm here with the business owner.
Okay. How about
I'm
you?
I'm a consultant.
Anyone else like to share their kind of their? Yeah, please. Thank you.
I have a very small business, but the one thing you didn't talk about, but I think is central to is the notion of accountability, pretty much to him, in that it's, you know, we've been given a business and he expects us to do something with it.
Yeah.
So the notion of accountability, I think, overlays all this. I don't know how that works.
How do you do that? That's just
I don't know how that works, but I just, I mean, I know that what drives me is that Someday I want to hear, well done, good and faithful servant, you know? And
this day, that day, I love that discussion.
And it kind of drives everything.
Yeah.
But each day, you know, I'll encounter something different, you know, and it's, so it's, you know, I got my plan and he's got his, and he kind of laughs when I kind of share mine.
But really.
I think we all are accountable. I mean,
sure.
Fundamentally, we've been given a life. We're supposed to do something with it, and it all starts from that.
There was one of the quotes, I can't remember it yesterday, was live your life and you realize at the end that it was all kind of, did you do the right things? I think that's really important. Yeah.
We have an interesting dilemma in that we sell a product through retail distribution channels, major retailers, and their interest is in
conflict. Do you have a handheld mic? Could you use, thank you. I really want to, thank you very much. Hello? Oh yeah, thanks a lot.
We have an interesting challenge in that our distribution channel is major retailers, and their interests are in conflict with our customers' interests.
Wow.
Because they want a low price, the one that we're selling through. They want a low price, they don't care about quality, and our end user customer is not all that concerned about price, but they're concerned about quality and value. And these conflicts affect us because our customers have a tendency to look at products that are similar but different in quality and assess them as being the same. So we're constantly dealing with pressures for unbelievable array of creative reasons why, oh, we have to have a better price. And we want to, part of our determination is to treat all customers equitably. Everybody has the same deal. Now, sometimes that doesn't mean the deals are identical for various reasons, but they're very close to identical across the board. And yet one guy comes to us and says, well, we need an extra 10% because blah, blah, blah. Well, I'm sorry, we can't do that. Well, we're going to drop your product.
Yeah.
Well, you'll have to drop the product. But so far, that's been a very rare thing that's happened. But the conflict between the end user customer and the distribution chain makes it a little bit more difficult than most people have in their situation. And then I think the majority of people in business are dealing directly with their customer.
Yeah,
but it's been a fun journey.
I'll bet it has. You know, and that's why I think the your value system is so important. You know, to be able to maintain your set of values and to, you know, stick true to those. I guess is that helpful in terms of, you know, how you treat customers in terms of equitability?
Yes.
Not an easy answer, is it?
No. But
yeah.
We do have a good reputation in
the
industry.
Yeah. Again, that word of mouth is powerful. Thank you. Is anybody else? Yeah, please.
Thank you.
So we own spas. My husband and I own 10 spas in California.
Oh, wow.
And so it's interesting because I look at what you say about ours is customer intimacy. Definitely. People
sure.
are trusting us. They take their clothes off with us. They literally, you know, so they're naked, and so they need all that trust. At the same time, we do facials. So product has to be excellent because we're on the cutting edge of what we're doing. And what we found was one of the biggest hindrances in our company was at the core level, at our highest management, there was a lack of trust. And so,
the lack of trust is with whom now?
It wasn't with our core managers, the very
level.
Sure. We have over 1,500 employees. And so what was interesting is we realized we brought in a psychologist to work with the top managers. And what we found was, he said something that changed my life, which was the difference between average people and highly successful people is their desire to have feedback. And so we realized that unless we were willing to get feedback, not only from our customers, which we always asked for, but from our managers, what was coming down through the ranks You know, they were afraid to talk to us. They were afraid to talk to the owners. They were afraid to talk to the managers. And when we took that fear out, when the bosses were no longer, they thought unapproachable. We didn't think we were, but we needed to hear that that was their impression of us. Things started changing throughout the company. There was a level of trust, and that created such greater intimacy all the way down the line.
Oh, wow. That's powerful.
Yeah.
And again, I think the thing about trust is that risk that they feared. They have
right.
that, be
right.
able to give you that feedback.
Yeah.
And trust and risk really are closely related.
Right.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.